Today's episode of the Retro Asylum podcast is proudly brought to you by Endangered Mice. For all the latest news and updates on the amazing Starquake remake, please check out www.endangeredmice.co.uk. Welcome to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum. I'm your host, Andy Godoy, and this is episode 24 and a half. And today I am joined by Damien.
Hello, everyone. How are you all doing?
Right. So for everyone that doesn't know, Damien is one of our forum members. He's also our site sponsor for this month. You go by the name of, is it Endangered Mice?
Yeah, that's a. You might want to know where the name Endangered Mice came from. And it's actually, if you were to reassemble the letters, it actually spells out my name.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so there we go. And I did this years ago because a mate of mine, we were sort of sat at work one day getting a bit bored. And so we thought, hey, let's do an anagram generator. And Endangered Mice was the one that was the most interesting for mine. I think a few rude words probably came out along the way as well, but not so good for a website. And it sort of carried on from there.
I think it's absolutely unique. It stands out and everything, and we're proud to actually have you as a sponsor. Now, before we move on why you sponsored us, what I want to find out first of all, like we always do, is how on earth did you find our little sites?
Well, I actually found your site through the 8-bit wars that you did on YouTube. This was at the time I was, well, and still now, this is when I was getting back into playing my games on the emulators before I started really going into collecting the actual computers. I've always been, you know, having been at school, various different people have different machines. I was probably quite uniquely, although I think there's a few of us, an Amstrad owner, which is why I'm always obsessed by Amstrads and the Amstrad games. And I had a lot of mates who had Spectrums and Commodore 64s and a few had BC Micros and stuff. So for me, it's really interesting because one of my mates had a C64 and I used to go over to his house and he'd get out a new game, which he'd just got. And I'd be like, oh, wow, that's absolutely amazing. And I, of course, rush home and get it for my Amstrad. And sometimes the game on the Amstrad was better. Sometimes it wasn't as good, and it was kind of, it's just really interesting to see your 8-bit wars comparison videos, because it was sort of, so this game, I remember, I thought it was really good on the Amstrad, but yeah, you might have thought it was better on the C64 or on the Spectrum. And it's just I like to see how the different conversions were made across the three main platforms.
Yeah, now it's interesting that you mentioned the Amstrad there. We'll move on to that in a little bit. Because you're the first proper Amstrad fan that we've actually had on this show. So I'm really dying to talk to you because I had an Amstrad. It was given to me. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, yeah, you were kind enough to sponsor us. You know, you've paid for the site hosting fees for the whole month. So that was really nice of you. And, like, me, Swaney, and, you know, Glenn are absolutely sort of ecstatic that you managed to do that.
Well, it's a really good thing to do because, you know, I haven't been able to help out on the site as much as I'd like to, because unfortunately in my case real life tends to get in the way all too often, and so to be able to actually do something positive, because I think it was just shortly after we'd been talking about getting merchandise ready for the show, and you were sort of saying, you know, I need to do this and that, and I was realizing that the costs are sort of adding up quite a bit for you, and, you know, really you're sort of trying to do that alone with the help of a few other people. But, you know, if we can all put a bit of money aside, then it really helps out. And actually, I'll let you in on a bit of a secret. What actually happened is, very nicely of the Inland Revenue, I got a letter and they gave me a bit of a tax refund, mainly because they sort of completely messed up my work expenses and had made me pay far too much tax over the previous year.
Right.
So I thought, well, you know, it's not free money. It's money that I was technically owed. But I thought, well, you know, I can take a little bit out of that and push it towards you guys. And here we are.
So maybe we should add that to the intro as well. You know, instead of just sponsored by Endangered Mice, also sponsored by the Inland Revenue as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they'll probably come and chase me there, because every time I get a letter, I'm like, oh Christ, what's it going to be? You know, you owe us £52,000 or something. And so far, it's always been good news. But I'm waiting for that letter that sort of that comes through the door with all big red writing on it, like, this is the end of your life, bahaha. But that hasn't happened yet, so hopefully we're okay.
Luckily enough.
Hello, this is Potty Boy, and you're listening to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum.
All right, so let's start right back at the beginning. Let's find out how you first got into gaming, your first memory of gaming. Why don't you tell us your story then, Damien?
Well, this is something I was thinking about the other day, and I think really my first memory of gaming goes all the way back. This is something that we saw at the show. Do you remember that sort of tennis game that we saw, which is kind of like a sort of...
The Binatone thing?
Yeah, it wasn't... One of my friends had one similar to that. It wasn't that actual one, and I can't remember what it was called. It was sort of a sort of long rectangular device, and it had about 12 different versions of... I think they call it tennis. It was basically Pong in different... with different sort of slightly different rules and stuff. And I remember you could flick this sort of 12-way switch and it would switch to different versions. And we had little paddle controllers on it. It was very, very basic. It was like Pong used to look like, really, with the two bats at either side and sort of net in the middle on some of the versions and so on. And we used to play that quite a lot. This is one of my mates who, I think his parents were quite rich. They had one of these, I think it was sort of in the sort of early 80s. And then one of my friends got a 48K ZX Spectrum. It's actually my next door neighbor, the old rubber keyboard version. And we played around on that for a year or so. And that must have been in about 1984, 1985. And I remember being really excited to go around to his house and play on his computer, because I didn't have one then. And funny enough, I was remembering back and thinking, what on earth did I used to do before I had a computer? And I really can't remember. Maybe I'd have spent all my time at his house.
Yeah.
Anyway, so moving on from that, I then pestered my parents to get me a computer for quite a long time, because my dad generally needs quite a lot of pestering before he sort of part with money to buy me something like that. And my dad, not knowing anything about computers whatsoever, basically went in and bought me this computer, which turned out to be an Amstrad CPC. And he didn't really know what he was doing, but I think he made a really, really fantastic decision, because the Amstrad, it was a bit more expensive than the others, which I was amazed that he actually bought that for me, but he did. But it came with the monitor, and so that meant that I didn't hog up the TV and you know, my computer, I could use it whenever I wanted to, and that was a really important thing for me.
What sort of monitor did you have? Because there was two different monitors. There was the green screen, and then there was the full-colour one. Were you one of the lucky ones that had the colour monitor?
I'm afraid to say, yes, I was. I was a very lucky boy. I did have the colour monitor, and in fact, I've still got it now, although it's currently in my shed, and it's probably wet. Hopefully,
oh, no.
It was working before. Yes. I had the color version, because I did have some friends with the green screen. Actually, not only did I have the color version, I now have to confess I actually had the CPC 6128, which is the disk drive and 128K Amstrad. So it was basically the equivalent of the Spectrum Plus 3, I suppose, in Amstrad terms. So I was very lucky actually to have both that and the color monitor.
First impressions then, when you first got given this Amstrad and it was put before you, you know, what was going through your mind?
Oh my God, I was completely blown away, because you know, the Amstrad at the time was such a neat looking machine. Computers did catch up later, especially when Amstrad acquired Spectrum. But back when I got the Amstrad, which was 1986, the Spectrum was still looking, it was looking better. The old 48 key, the rubber keyboard version had gone by the wayside, and they repackaged it, didn't they, into the Plus model, I think, into the Plus 2. And it was looking nicer, but it still didn't come with a monitor. And the Commodore 64 still, well, it was that sort of fairly horrible brown bread box, which did sort of evolve into sort of meager-looking sort of C64S, but that didn't come until quite a lot later. So I felt that as a machine, the Amstrad looked a lot more professionally built, I think. I mean, if you tap a Commodore 64, it sounds hollow. And when you take it apart, it is hollow. You know, it's really got lots of space in it, I suppose, for cooling and stuff. But the Amstrad was a much more robust machine. It's like picking up a sort of solid piece of plastic. And that was great. And so I love the look of the thing. But most importantly for me, I think, as a great machine to have, apart from the monitor, was the disk drive, because having used Spectrums and Commodore 64s with their, all my friends exclusively had tape decks, no one had a disk drive. And so, whacking that disk in and loading up the game, it would take about, 5-10 seconds to load, whereas on a tape you could be waiting anything up to 5 minutes. So enormous difference, really was, and that was just a great thing to have.
What were some of these games then that you used to load up? What were the first few games that you loaded up on your Amstrad?
Well, the first disc that came in my Amstrad became one of the most important discs I ever owned, and this is in 1986, and it was a compilation called the Amtix Accolades. Now, Amtix were a computer magazine that ran to about 23 issues, I think, before they got absorbed into another magazine. I think it was CPC Computing. Mm-hmm. And like Crash Smashes in Crash Magazine, they had games which they rated very highly. And this was basically a four-game compilation of recent Amtix accolades. And on there were four very... Well, actually, I'll probably say three classic games. One that I like less, but nevertheless has become a bit of a classic. But Side 1 have Monty on the Run.
Yeah.
And Suivo's World, if anyone remembers that. It's a bit of a bizarre adventure.
No, I don't remember that one at all.
You need to look that one up. It's a little bit like a sort of early version of Night Law. I'm not sure if it might have come out after Night Law, actually, thinking about it. But it's a very, you sort of play this sort of very strange looking character who's this sort of robot. And I think his job is to sort of clear up this very messy planet. And it's full of sort of senses of humor, a sense of humor and stuff. So you sort of score brownie points. I think you have to catch turkeys. And it's very, very odd. Yeah. Well worth checking out. So that was Side 1. And then Side 2 had this is a game that I like less. It's a game called Bounder.
Oh yeah.
We play the tennis ball, and it's an interesting game, but it's so hard. It really is. I was playing it the other day on the Amstrad emulator with a cheat, and I completed it in the end only because I had infinite lives and blah blah blah. But it was so difficult, even with the cheat, to do. And I just could never imagine how someone could do it without cheating. But I guess someone has. But very hard. So then, the fourth and final game on that disc is. Was a little unknown number called Starquake. that is the game that I have the most memories of loading up on that machine, and that was simply because it's probably for me one of the most amazing games ever made. And this is right from the get-go, so I've always sort of been into my sort of sci-fi and fantasy stuff, and because Starquake was set in space, that immediately made it very exciting.
Yeah,
and I remember loading it up, and just the graphics were fantastic, and the music was really good as well, really atmospheric, and it was the best of it was it was an adventure game with 512 screens, which if you think about it, that's an enormous amount of game map to explore. And if you consider how many different machines this game was converted to, including the BBC Micro that had a very small 32 kilobytes of memory, it's just such an amazing achievement. But really, when I remember watching your 8-bit review of Starquake, which you very kindly did for me probably about a year or so ago, one of the things that you said is that you really don't quite know what's going on with this game, but you're just trying things out. And that is exactly how I approached a game back in 1986. I had no idea what I had to do. Okay, I could have read the instructions, but I didn't, because no one does when they're about 9. You just get into it and do it. And really, what I used to do, as you were doing when you were reviewing it, I just used to explore the game, and it was so brilliantly varied. I mean, the graphics just changed all the time, and it was always, you could get that little bit further each time, or you could find a way to access a new area. And it's just the excitement to say, what graphics are they going to draw next? What sort of world am I going to be in? Am I going to be in a rocky world? Am I going to be in a sort of jungle terrain? And it's just so fantastically varied that was really what I spent really the first probably year or so just doing, was just exploring it. And then inevitably, as you get used to the game, you understand what the mission is a bit more. You work out how to complete it. And eventually I did complete it. And I was like, wow, that's the first game I completed without cheating.
So how long did this game actually take you to complete? And did you have any help, anyone sitting there with you, guiding you along?
What I did is, funny enough, it's one of the games my dad used to play with me as well, because he loves it too. And so we both sort of explored it, and him being obviously significantly older than me, wasn't quite as sort of dexterous with the joystick and stuff. I think he got better as he moved on. But really, no, I mean, we managed to figure it out on our own, and it's really because it's quite a, once you work out, the key to the game is, because it's such a big playing area, There's a load of teleporters that can take you to different parts of the area, but they all have different teleport codes. And they're almost like sort of save game positions. They're not, but the codes are always the same. So if you spend ages getting to a particular section, the first thing to do is once you get in there is you try and find the nearest teleport, get in there, write down the code, and then you can get to that point, you know, in the future, should you lose all your lives, which inevitably you're going to do. And so really, once I've worked out, you know, teleports have teleport codes and they're always the same, you basically just go around and you map the game out and you work out where all these teleports are, you write them all down. Of course, yeah, if you can find one in some sort of distant part of the map, note down the code, play again and then get straight to there immediately, then with the more lives you've got, then you've got a much better chance of getting further on from there.
I just find it amazing, Damien, that you spent so much time on this game. You really know it inside out. We'll talk about what you're working on at the moment a little bit further down the line, but I'm just amazed that these games back in the day, because they were huge, you know, and you managed to finish it. It's really impressive.
I didn't realise actually at the time that it was that impressive. And having read subsequent reviews of the game, and lots of people sort of said, "Oh, it's impossible to complete." I know. I mean, to be honest, I think it just goes to show if you play a game enough and you like it enough and you get to know it enough, then you will complete it. Because I mean, back in the day, one of my best friends had a Commodore 64, and he's got a bit of a gift for playing games. I mean, he really has. He used to complete games all the time, and I was just astonished. I remember going around to his house, and I used to enjoy watching him play it more than actually playing the games and something, because, you know, it's very exciting watching him get through it and get a little bit further than I'd try. But like, this is impossible. How do you do this? And he just somehow had that ability. And I think his secret was he actually just played stuff a hell of a lot, actually. I think that's what he did. He seemed very good. But and that was really interesting, because that's my sort of introduction into the Commodore 64. And, you know, really, that is an amazing machine as well. You know,
that's the other thing I wanted to get onto then, because you're the first Amstrad fan. What would you say the Amstrad main advantages were, say, over the C64 and the ZX Spectrum? Because there was that big 8-bit wars back in the day, and most people either went for the C64 or the ZX Spectrum.
I think the big advantage of the Amstrad, well, there's two different distinct ones. The first one over the ZX Spectrum is it didn't suffer from the attribute clash that the ZX Spectrum had. So this is just the way the screen memory is laid out. And in order to save memory, they basically do the color in blocks of 8x8 pixels. You can only have two colors within that block. And if two different blocks cross over themselves and the other block having different colors, one of them will overwrite the other. So you get this sort of strange color blending. Yeah. The Amstrad didn't have that. And its disadvantage with that is in the sort of similar resolution to the Spectrum, it could only do four colors, where the Spectrum could do the whole, I think Spectrum had 8 or 16 colors. Was it 8? I can't remember now.
I'm not sure.
But it could put all of its colors on the screen, but only in 8x8 blocks of two colors in each block. So it was kind of a trade-off, but I think the Amstrad could look better because of that. Of course, the Amstrad had another lower resolution mode, which is kind of similar to the Commodore 64's low resolution mode, which allowed 16 colors. Now, okay, two machines in that way are almost on a par, although I think the Commodore 64 has attribute problems as well. I think it's allowed four colors per 8x8 block. I'll have to look this up because I can't remember offhand. So that allows a lot more variation. Of course, with the Commodore having its hardware sprites, which could have independent colors, attribute clash never really was a problem on that machine.
Yeah.
So obviously, the Commodore 64 had its sprites. The Amstrad didn't have its hardware sprites. But what the Amstrad could do is it had much better color palette.
Yeah,
had 26 colors. Now, people joke about the Commodore 64, and they still, and it still now is, it's got, you know, about 16 different shades of brown, which I think in a sense is actually quite true. And
it is completely. Now, I've been looking at some games like Chase HQ, Barbarian, and on the Amstrad, they look absolutely beautiful, really, really bright, really colored. It's really dazzling, some of these games.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, another one I'd add to that list is the Sacred Armor of Antriad as well, which looked absolutely amazing on the Amstrad. It just had a very vibrant color palette. And the way they worked that is, I think they literally just went from the sort of 0 to 255, which is how you would define sort of different color channels in a color palette. And I think they just basically went along, and I think they sort of divided it by four and just mixed all the four combinations up to make this sort of all the colors that the Amstrad could do. And so it's a very sort of crude way of doing it, but it worked very well because it just gave you a nice sort of consistent level of colors in all sorts of different combinations. I don't know if they knew that it was going to turn out like that at the time, or whether it's just we're designing some hardware, this is how we're going to do it, nice, simple and easy. But that's how they did it. And it does make the games, I think, when the colors are used well, it makes them look really, really good.
Yeah.
But the disadvantage with the Amstrad, or, well, I would say probably more badly programmed Amstrad games, is that because there isn't really any hardware acceleration, a bit like the Spectrum as well, that it's much harder to get good things out of the machine. There are a few hardware tricks you can do, but you need to be a very skillful programmer. And back in the day, with sort of pressures of having to get games out to a very quick turnaround, plus with the Amstrad market being quite a lot smaller than the Spectrum and the Commodore one, people just didn't really always spend all the time and effort into really taking advantage of all those features because it was harder to do. And so Amstrad games would suffer quite a lot from that. They'd either be, the scrolling would be jerky, or they would get a bit slow. I mean, the Amstrad does run a bit slow when you get a lot of stuff on screen, something which the Spectrum suffers with a lot less, and the Commodore 64, of course, its hardware sprites suffers from almost not at all. And so quite often you could get some really slow Amstrad games. It's kind of like, you know, wading through treacle trying to play these games. It was very disappointing in some instances, but when done well, it could be just as fast as the other machines. It's just down to the skills of the programmers. And if anyone is interested in sort of looking at this and discussing this, there's a wonderful forum. I'll just do them a plug here because they're really good.
Of course.
It's the cpcwiki.eu. So it's www.cpcwiki.eu. And they're a Wikipedia site dedicated to the Amstrad. They've got some fantastic guys on there, and you can sort of, they're still programming a thing now. I've had a little bit of a go myself, and it's, you know, see, back in the day, and they're still writing some fantastic routines on the machines. And if you've got, you can run these routines in emulators like WinApe and stuff. And it's just, if you're interested in what the Amstrad could do, it's a really good site to check out and have a look at.
Well, the other thing I wanted to quickly bring to attention, you slightly touched upon it there. What was your view then of, like, just the Amstrad? You know, they had a lot of Spectrum type conversions where it was basically the Spectrum game but on the Amstrad. What was your view on that?
That was a really difficult one, because at the time I was pretty devastated that a lot of specky ports, as they call them, were coming out on the Amstrad. You know, they were very easy to do because the Amstrad and Spectrum had the same processor. The actual Spectrum display could be emulated on Amstrad relatively easily because you could reprogram the video controller. That's one of the cool things the Amstrad could do. Unfortunately, it led to the Spectrum port being a very widespread thing. And what a lot of companies did is they wrote a lot of predefined routines that would basically convert Spectrum graphics to the Amstrad. And then they could, of course, use them again and again. You could convert the keyboard input. The actual game code itself would run on the Amstrad as the same processor. So, port the code over, run a few of these little conversion libraries, and hey, presto, you've got a game running immediately. And the problem with that is, because effectively the games were being converted in real time to Amstrad code, the games would run slower on the Amstrad than the Spectrum. That's because of the overhead of doing the conversion. So, of course, all those things added together, Spectrum ports are a really, really bad thing in some ways. But then, of course, it's important to realize that the Amstrad games market was smaller than the Spectrum and the Commodore. And without the Spectrum ports, I think we would have seen far fewer games on the Amstrad. I think it just wouldn't have happened so much. And so, in one way, it was really bad, but the other flip side of the coin is, well, at least you got to see the game, and you wouldn't have got that otherwise. So, you know, it's a tricky one. I was always disappointed, but some of the Spectrum ports were really, really good, and I did enjoy them because it was a great game.
Hey, everybody, this is Buzzbot from Oddpod and the Free Bees podcast. You're listening to the most greatest, funkiest retro gaming podcast in the world, Retro Asylum.
All right, the next thing I want to talk about then, you've mentioned a little bit about the Amstrad. Why don't you mention some of the other machines briefly that you've owned?
Well, yes, I mean, I've owned not many machines. I now own a great deal, because I'll get onto this a bit later. I now collect them. But back in the day, I didn't actually own a console, for example, until the N64 came out.
Right, okay. So, I mean, from the Amstrad, then, the N64 was your natural...
That was my first console, and that's because I went to university, and GoldenEye came out, and we wasted our entire life just playing GoldenEye. It was amazing. So the reason why I didn't have consoles is because I've always been a programmer, a developer, and I've always been interested from day one in programming computers. And this went back to when my mate had his 48K Spectrum, and trying to program that with a rubber keyboard, I nearly threw it through the window so many times, because not only did it have a rubber keyboard that was utterly awful to type on, it also had this bizarre basic input system where you different key combinations to write different basic keywords, which is fine if you get very used to it, but
yeah,
it wasn't a natural way of typing. I wanted to type the commands in separately, and if you did that, it'd give you a syntax error, and it was just a nightmare. It was horrifying. So I was delighted when I got my Amstrad with its proper keyboard, and so I've always had computers because of this. So I learned to program the Amstrad, did a bit of Z80 assembly, but it got to about 91, 92, and really the Amstrad wasn't really cutting the mustard anymore. And of course the big 16-bit machines had come out. In fact, the Amiga had been out probably as long as the Amstrad in various different iterations, but far too expensive to buy back then. But in 1992 the Amiga 1200 came out. Mm-hmm. And I eventually upgraded and got one of those, and that was, again, I bought that because it was a computer with a keyboard that could be programmed. And a lot of people have asked me, you know, why didn't you go and get a PC? Well, I didn't get a PC because the graphics were crap at the time. The sound was crap. It was a lot more expensive. And I was very much into film and video, and I was doing a number of art courses at school that involved animation production, mm-hmm. and film production. And these are sort of courses where we had to make little videos and stuff, and for that the Amiga was an absolutely perfect machine.
Yeah,
it was so good at what it did, and the fact that you could connect it directly up to a video machine through the video output was just, you know, it just made it a no-brainer for me. So that's why I had the Amiga. But it was having these machines and having something like the Amiga, it's made me, when I've been writing code, absolutely obsessed with getting it all to run very smoothly. And that's one of the things I try to do in all the games that I write. So unless it runs perfectly, it's not worth doing. And a lot of PC conversions, because of funny old monitor refresh rates and stuff, they used to skip around because they try and basically get it to run at a, and I'll get very technical here, but we'll do it anyway.
Sorry, no problem.
As people may or may not know, the PAL video format in the UK runs at 50 cycles a second. So that basically means that you have about 50 frames a second on the machines, and in NTSC world that's 60. And I could go into a lot deeper technicalities, but I'm not going to. But essentially, what would happen is when you're synchronizing a video game to the screen, you have 50 frames a second, the game will run at a certain speed because 50 times your character will move per second.
Yeah.
Now you get onto a PC where back in the day the monitors used to run at all sorts of funny refresh rates. Sometimes they start at 60 cycles a second, then going up to 75 or 80. Now the problem with that is if you synchronize to the screen, your game's going to run too fast because suddenly it's trying to draw in 80 times a second. So you've got a percentage increase there. So what they used to do is they used to do quite a crude division of dividing 50 into 80 and like move one and a bit frames a second. And the problem with that is it just looks jerky because the two things don't synchronize together perfectly. And that's why, you know, you go down to your local arcade and you play sort of like Chase HQ, for example, or R-Type. You see that lovely Commodore 64 did the same thing, and Amiga. You see that lovely, silky, smooth scrolling background, and you get onto your PC and play it, and it looked like a heap of crap because they're trying to get the speed to run on a higher refresh monitor. And it was one of those things that still sort of plagues PC games a little bit to the present day, although with 3D cards, you can run at any refresh rate that you like, and it doesn't matter. They've got a different speed scaling system, but for 2D stuff, it's still a bit of a problem. And I'm someone that works in film and television, and I'm absolutely obsessed with everything being synchronized absolutely perfectly.
This is Matt Dinaris. When the modern world is taking its toll on me, I tune into the Retro Asylum podcast.
Right, now what I want to do now is move on to the main topic that I wanted to discuss with you. Now, you're working on a little Starquake remake, which has been, what, 10 years in the making?
Yeah, it's an absolutely epic thing. I wrote the, as people who would have checked out my site, I've recently written a post called The Starquake Remake Story, and that was actually inspired by speaking to you and Swainy at the weekend, because we were sort of just talking about, what it's been through. And I put the dates together, and I've got all the different files on my computer. I looked at the dates, like, my God, this has been going on for 10 years.
Wow.
That's astonishing, and I can't believe it, really. But this is an example of life sort of gets in the way all the time. It does, invariably does. And for anyone writing a computer game, especially the guys recently, the voluntary group who have released the Half-Life remake called Black Mesa, I'm just astounded by what they've managed to do in a relatively short space of time, because, I mean, maybe they don't do anything else, but it's really, really hard to do stuff. And the reason Starquake's taken 10 years it isn't just because I've been hideously slow. It's because it's been a real learning experience for me. And the game has got about three different versions. And I started it 10 years ago in a completely different program language to the one it's in now. Mm-hmm. And it's had code conversions. It's had graphics conversions. It's kind of a bit like Duke Nukem Forever, I suppose, because I went through so many different game engines. And it was always difficult because I was writing it on my own, although I did have some collaboration for a bit, but the mate who I was in it with unfortunately had to drop out because his real life got in the way. It's very hard because I wanted it. I mean, basically, I could never use a game creator to do it because it had to be absolutely, I needed to have full control over how the game ran.
Yeah.
So as someone who's a programmer anyway, to be able, I just, you know, I can't do that. I know I can do better. So mm-hmm. that's exactly what I did. But really the problem was is because it turned out to be quite a complicated project. It is quite a difficult and complicated game to write. And if you start playing it, you look at it superficially and think, oh yeah, it's a very simple game. Just a few characters moving around screen. That's great. But actually start to pull it apart. You suddenly realize this, how much work has gone in there. Stephen Crowe did an amazing job.
What I was going to ask you, as a big fan of the game and you used to play it all the time and you finished it, and as a programmer now, tell us what you thought once you really started discovering, you know, behind the game really and everything he managed to do.
I'm just astonished. I mean, because, you know, today we can write games in much simpler code in mm-hmm. things like C++. I know it compared to assembly language, it is relatively simple. I mean, people probably say, oh my God, C++ is really hard. Yeah, try assembly language. That is very, very hard. And, you know, the fact he was doing this back in sort of 1984 and just the depth to the game and the amount of work he put into it and writing it all in that very low level program language, which he did, it is just an amazing achievement. And how he managed to fit the entire game logic and all the graphics into a certain, you know, amount of memory is just amazing. And you know, nowadays when as developers, any of you guys out there that do software development, we've got an enormous amount of tools that really help you to do the job for debugging code and for mm-hmm. Nice little code editors and stuff like that. Now, when I was back writing Z80 assembly language on the Amstrad, I had my assembly program on disk, and I literally used to have to boot up CPM, if anyone remembers what that was. It was a operating system for various computers back in the day. I had to boot up CPM, type the code into the text editor, then assemble it, then I had to reset the machine, load up the binary file that I would have created. And the whole thing, because it is on disk, it took about, you know, 2 minutes to go through the whole process every time to make a bit of a change. And you couldn't, it was very hard to debug programs as well. You could do it, but the debuggers that we had back then for checking for bugs, seeing what the sort of memory state is like, you know, they were not as friendly as we've got today. And it was a real, you basically had to write a lot of stuff just off the top of your head, hoping that it would work. And inevitably, you know, with assembly language, if you do something wrong, your machine will crash or do something very odd and you'll lose that code. So you have to continually save it. And we're very lucky today, you know, run some code today and go, oh, that went a bit wrong. And we'll say, you know, this blah, 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 blah is broken. And 9 times out of 10, your PC won't crash and you can go and resolve that. But back in the day, very, very difficult. And, you know, having limited memory in your computer, having to have the game code in memory, plus your assembler and your editor, it was so difficult. So I think, you know, absolutely amazed at what he managed to do. And again, all those games writers that just wrote amazing games back in the day, and, you know, astonishing achievements. And even now, you know, with all the great tools we got now, it's hard to do going back to assembly language, because we've got the WinApers emulator, for example, has some fantastic debuggers for Z80 assembly. It makes it a lot easier. It's still hard to do. And it's something I've been playing around with a bit, but it's very time consuming. So
what's been the best thing and worst thing about working on the StarQuake remake then?
I think the best thing is definitely being able to realize the game in a modern format. I mean, that's what and the feedback I've got from it so far has been absolutely wonderful. It's been really good, very, very positive comments. That feels really good, because it really is a labor of love. You do it for no money at all, but you do it because you love the game and because you want to release something that you're proud of and that people hopefully, you know, look at favorably and say, oh, I did a really good job there. That's a nice feeling. And really, you know, the best of it is as well is it's because it's been evolving for 10 years. As I got better as a programmer in my day-to-day job, I've been able to incorporate that into the game, and I'm continually, you know, improving sections of the code, making it better. So And also it's you know, it's writing a game which is very different to what I do, you know, during work hours, and it's nice to have that different thing to do in the evenings or whenever I have some free time. So that I think that's the best thing. I think I think the worst thing is probably just trying to get it finished, and it's really difficult because you feel that you're getting closer towards the end, and I'm on my third version of it now. When I first started writing it, I probably didn't really have enough game writing experience, I guess, and I got to a stage where it did get to about 90% complete, but the structure of the code was so horrible that there's so many little subtle bugs just because the code itself hadn't really been written very well I kind of got that point going, well, I can't really finish it. I could finish it and spend hours hacking away, but I just lost so much enthusiasm at that point. And I'm very particular about how code's written nowadays, and it has to be, as perfect as I can make it or as good as I can make it. And so you do continue to find yourself rewriting bits and pieces because they don't quite work in the way that you want to. And again, that sort of delays it all the time. So it's a very difficult discipline. You have to sort of have an end in sight, and you've got to look at it and decide, that bit's done now. I can't go back to it because I'm never going to get this damn thing finished. And this is why, as people that read the site and probably been announced on the forum as well, this is why I've got my target end date is 2013, September 2013, hopefully September / October to time with Replay Expo. And that's just because I think I can probably easily do it in that time. It's just really, the game is probably now 95% done. And it's using the little demos and stuff I've been putting up on YouTube. And the thing is, there's lots of little bits and pieces I want to add. So basically, I've got to get the main code finished, and then I'll start adding little details in, because details just really are the thing that make a game. It's just nice little graphic effects and stuff, and people go, oh, that's really nice, I like that. And it just gives your feeling of when you're playing a game, it just enhances it so much more, rather than just, I could release it now and say, well, here it is, with all the stuff in place now. There's just a few little things I want to do. It's kind of like a painting. You never quite finish it, but this is going to have to come out at some stage.
Is there a fear though that you put too much time into it and you might go a little bit too much, a little bit overboard on it, or is that you're aiming just to constantly perfect it the whole time?
I mean, basically that's part of the discipline, and that's where I've had to sort of kick myself up the arse and say, no, you can't do any more, you can't spend any more time on that bit. And my day-to-day job has been wonderful in this respect. It's taught me to work to deadline, and we have to work to deadline all the time. So we're constantly releasing code that it works well enough, but it's not as perfect as we could have it. But we've got customers that sort of said, well, I need this immediately. So you just have to, you fire and forget, really. And that happens all the time. And in the real world, you don't ever really finish everything as perfectly as you'd like. And so I'm trying to put the same sort of discipline into this remake as well. And the most important thing about doing something like this is a feeling of progress. And so I do have my little text file, which is my change log, and I'm constantly sort of writing down little things that I've done to it. And I've got a sort of a things to do list as well. So as long as I'm scratching those off, which I am,
yeah,
this things to do list is empty, it's like, whoa, the game's done. That's great. And that's, you've just got to be very disciplined. What I used to do is just sort of jump in and start, typing away and doing stuff, but you don't, without a sort of, just a basic plan, just get yourself a piece of paper or just have a Word document, whatever. Just have something that has everything down that you need to do and just go through them, tick them off. And that's the only way you're going to finish anything, I think. And that's really what I've been trying to do.
Now, what I want to find out, you mentioned earlier that you've recently started collecting. At which point did you start collecting games again, or consoles?
Yeah, well, I started it, I'm trying to think when it actually started and how it happened. I think, well, it basically initially happened through, not really pure accident, through me just not throwing away my old computers. And so I've got I bought my N64, which I still have. Amazingly, it survived university somehow and still works, which is astonishing. But there we go. And then I've still got my Amiga 1200. One or two people have given me machines. I got an Amiga 1200 from a friend of mine who emigrated to Canada, and he didn't want to take it to Canada with him. And he said, I don't want to throw it away. And I was like, well, okay, I'll have it. And so I acquired Amiga 1200 from that. And then,
fantastic.
I know, it's brilliant. And in a similar way, I managed to get a SNES about 2 months ago from another friend of mine who found it in his loft.
Which
is just incredible. And it had Street Fighter 2 with it. I mean,
even better.
That was brilliant. And you know, he sort of brought it over. It was a bit yellowed. So it's a technique which you might have seen online where people actually use hair products, bleach, to bring the cases, take the yellowing out of the cases.
Yeah.
That actually worked quite well. So if anyone looks it up, it must look really odd because I ordered all this hair, this hair product, which came to the post. I had to go pick it up at the post office. And fortunately, it got through, but I could just imagine being arrested for trying to start some sort of chemical. It was astonishing. So that one came through. And then at the same time, again, when I'm talking about earlier about wanting things to look as good as possible,
yeah,
and playing games on emulators is great, but sometimes, you know, well, I'll be playing a game, it'll start getting jerky. That's because my PC suddenly decided to do something ridiculous in the background, which is absolutely fine. I think emulation's a really, really cool thing to be able to do, but I do like running stuff on original hardware because you get that really smooth sort of scrolling and stuff that you might not get through a PC emulator. So I went hunting for an Amstrad because I wanted to get back into Z80 assembly. Of course, I could on WinApe, the Amstrad emulator, but I actually wanted to see what it looked like on the actual machine as well. There's certain things with the original monitor that you can't do on an emulator. Certain things that just won't work, but they'll work fine on an emulator. So it's quite interesting from that perspective. So eBay became my friend and from that point onwards. And because I repair computers sometimes as well, I tend to look around on eBay for things that are already broken because 9 times out of 10 people don't actually want them, which is great. Mm-hmm. So I acquired an Amstrad that someone had butchered. They basically cut a load of tracks and circuit board and the whole thing was buggered when I got a hold of it. So I spent about 3 weeks actually fault finding it and soldering all the wires back in there and replacing the dead chips. And I finally got a machine that worked, which is great. I mean, it's a great moment to actually resurrect an old machine. And so I got hold of that one. And then someone else has said an Amstrad that actually went, I put a sort of random bid on it on eBay for about 20 quid or so. And I was the only bidder. And it's because it was sort of located somewhere in Wales, I think, and no one wanted to pick it up.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, living in Cheltenham, it was only a few, you know, about 20 miles down the road. I was like, oh, okay, excellent. So I got hold of that one as well. And so then I had a sort of small computer collection, and I've really just been adding to it, and I've been getting hold of the machines. I've got a BBC Model B, which the BBC was also a machine I had a lot of involvement with back in the day because we had them at school.
Yeah, that's right.
It's another one that I used to program, and in lunch breaks sometimes when I wasn't doing other things like playing football. And what was great about the BBC, it had some, you know, fantastic games on it. One of my favourite ones being Repton, for example, absolutely amazing. It had some really good arcade conversions as well, Defender and Pac-Man and stuff. So, and Chucky Egg, that was the first time I saw Chucky Egg.
Classic, yeah.
Absolutely amazing game. And so really, it's a bit of a special machine for me as well. So I got hold of one of those. And then I started looking at sort of slightly rarer machines, I suppose, or less popular ones, probably a better way of putting it. And from there, I got hold of an Archimedes A3000, mm-hmm. which was the successor to the BBC Micro. And that's a very powerful machine, actually. I hadn't realized just how good it was. And it had quite a lot of conversions from Amiga games. So things like GOTS came out on it. And the machine has virtually no hardware video at all, but because it has this ridiculously fast RISC processor, it could actually use the power of the CPU to actually make the graphics look just as good in many cases as the Amiga. So that was a really amazing achievement on that machine. So that was a sort of slightly rarer one I got. But then, because I'm an Amstrad fan, and I got an Amiga 1200 at this stage, but just before the Amigas, I think the Amiga 1200 came out, and when the 500 and stuff was around, Amstrad made their own sort of Amiga / Atari sort of lookalike. And those of you that don't know, it was a machine called an Amstrad Plus. And it was very similar to CPC. So it's still an 8-bit machine, still a Z80 processor. But they basically created a custom graphics chip, which allowed you to have hardware scrolling and hardware sprites.
Right, okay.
It's kind of a bit like an Amstrad / Commodore 64. And actually, had it come out back in 1985, I think it would have made an absolute killing. Sadly, it came out too late, and the world had moved on to 16-bit machines, and it looked a bit like an Amiga. I've actually got a post coming up on my website. I was thinking I had it out already, but I don't.
Yeah.
Which is talking about this Plus machine. I've actually already got one about replacing the Plus keyboard. Basically, cut a long story short, these Plus machines generally go on eBay for stupid money. I mean, we're talking about £150 to £200, wow. And that's because they're quite rare. UK, but in France, which had a very, very healthy CPC market, there's loads of Plus machines around. And so I actually got onto a wonderful site called Amibay. I don't know if anyone's used it. It's another very good site for tracking down computers. Right. And you can go on there and put a wanted ad in. And I did. And this wonderful guy called Chris from France responded back saying, I think I've got just what you're looking for. I've got this Amstrad. Yeah. And I was like, oh, mate, this sounds great. You know, how much money do you want for it? Or do you want to do a machine swap? And it just so happened that I had to... Archimedes A3000, so I bought a job lot of broken ones, and out of three that I bought, I got two that worked, and I didn't need two. And he's you know what, I really fancy an Acorn Archimedes A3000. I said, ah, oh, wow, that's great news, because I've got one here, you want Amstrad Plus, let's do a swap. And so for so it cost me about 40 quid because I had to send the bloody thing through the post system, which cost a fortune. But I got I essentially got an Amstrad Plus for £40, which was great, and it all worked.
That's amazing.
And compared to 150, brilliant. And there we go.
Now, what I wanted to find out, you mentioned you've got quite a few machines there. Where do you actually keep them? And what does Lucy think of the, your collection and your being into games and so on?
Well, Lucy herself, she's into a few games. I mean, she will play... We recently got Bubble Bobble on the Xbox 360 because it's one of the games that she really likes. And so we're playing two-player through that and just... realizing how impossible some of the screens are. And so she likes stuff like that. I mean, calling an avid gamer would be a lie. She'll sort of dip into it. Okay, she said she won't play anything modern. I mean, if I load up to her, like I don't know, Rage on the Xbox or something, she'll she'll just start reading a book or do something else or leave the room. not really her bag at all, but the sort of the classic games where you've got little characters running around, she really likes those, so that's really good. So anyway, she's very happy for me to do my gaming stuff, but I have a cupboard in the office which houses all these machines. They're not allowed to untidy and around the house, otherwise they get cleared away. And there's this sort of there's technically a one in one out policy that hasn't really been happening recently because I found a lot of extra cupboard space. You organise a cupboard in such a way you can actually get a load of stuff in there. So that's what I've been doing. I think I need to count up the machines. I think there's about 10 or 12 machines in there. They all sort of fit in quite nicely. So so far so good. I mean, what I want to do is what you've got, which is fantastic, is your gaming shed.
It's still not been done. I was clearing out that the other day, but eventually that will be my little place to have things.
And that's going to be great. Unfortunately, our garden's really not quite big enough. We have a little shed which used to be an outside loo, God knows when, but it's got a toilet roll holder in there, which is great. But it's quite long and thin, It was going to be a sort of gaming shed, but now apparently the barbecue and the garden furniture has to go in there. So I've got a feeling it's probably going to be a garden furniture and barbecue store. It was certainly over the winter, so I'm probably going to have to wait a little bit longer until we have a bigger garden for a gaming shed. But it would be amazing if I had one of those. It'd be absolutely great.
Right, now I've got two more sections that I want to deal with you. Now, this next bit is like a desert island disc sort of type game. Now, you've already mentioned Starquake, so you can't pick Starquake. So if there's one game you could play on this deserted island that for some reason has electricity so you can play these things, what game would that be, and who would you have? Like, it can be anyone, alive, dead, from the past, present, to help, you know, to play this game with you.
That's a really interesting question. That's a really difficult one to answer, actually, because I've been sort of racking my brains. Would it be a classic game? Would it be a more modern game? And I'd be tempted by sort of some of these sort of cinematic adventures, stuff like Alan Wake and Half-Life. But the problem with those is once you've played them through, there's kind of, you don't really want to play it again because you've done it all.
Yeah.
And so it's probably going to have to be something that's a little bit more basic than that, and something you can come back to again and again. And I'm just sort of racking my brain and thinking what that might be. And what do I continually play all the time? And I mean, it's really difficult. I mean, probably something like Jet Set Willy would be very high up on my list because I absolutely love that game. And it because it's so hard, I think I'd probably spend the rest of my life trying to complete it. I mean, I think the original Spectrum version you couldn't complete because there are a few bugs in it. I think the Amstrad version with the extra screens you can. Mm-hmm. So it may have to be Jet Set Willy, the Final Frontier, I think, because I just loved that game so much. And the fact that you could go off into space in it, it was just superb. Now, who would I play it with? That's a really interesting story. It'd probably be, this is difficult, isn't it? Let me think. I mean,
would it be a program? I mean, I could, old days, or would it be some sort of movie star, or like just someone, just random?
to be honest, it'd probably be really nice to have Matt Smith out there, who actually wrote the game. Actually beat him over the head every time I couldn't get through a bit because he made it too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I could probably spend eternity talking to him anyway about how he made the game and stuff. So that'd probably be a really interesting character to have out there. He's also raving mad as well, which might...
And you could swap stories about Amsterdam.
Absolutely, yeah. Good. He's absolutely bonkers, but I love him. He's brilliant.
No, it's absolutely fantastic. All right, so we've got one more section of this podcast, which is my favourite section of the podcast, and it's a section called Name the Game. Now, let me explain to our listeners who may have not heard this. I think of a game, and Damien's basically got to try and guess the game. He asked me questions, and I can only answer in yes or no. So, are you ready?
I think I am, yes. This is going to be interesting because I've listened to a few of them recent podcasts and I've known a few of them, but others I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea. So this is going
to
be
the secret is to ask as many questions as possible and then you'd be able to do it. So I think this is a pretty easy one. So our listeners who are listening to this, why don't you join in and see if you can guess it before Damien. All right, Damien, name the game.
Right, okay. Is it a platform game?
Nope.
Does it involve fighting?
Nope.
Okay. Is it an arcade game? That's probably a good start.
Yes.
And is it a recent game?
No.
Did it come out on 8-bit computers?
Yes.
Okay, this helps. Did it come out on consoles?
Yes.
Okay, so it's quite a universal game then. But it doesn't involve fighting.
I like the way you're doing this, very like Sherlock Holmes deductiveness.
Well, yes, the problem is, can I actually work it out? Yeah, exactly. Well, I think he's got a vast intellect, which I probably can't even begin to hope to match, but I'll do my best. Okay, so... is it set in a maze?
No.
It's not set in a maze. And... Okay, do you have to pick things up?
Nope.
Okay, right. This is very interesting. Gosh, your brain always goes blank when you're trying to... I know what it's like on those game shows now. So it's not... So, Kia, is it a shoot-em-up?
It is indeed.
Okay, is it R-Type?
Well done. Fantastic.
That was a bit random, actually. What could it be? It's actually, R-Type's one of my favourite games.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I basically brought it up, because recently at Replay Expo, we were talking about the amazing Amstrad remake.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I was very... I need to put a post up about this, actually, because the Amstrad remake was a superb undertaking. It really has made the game what it always should have been on the Amstrad. I'm actually in touch with a few of the guys that wrote that. And one of them, a chap called Toto, who's on the CPC Wiki forum, he's one of the authors of the game, Easter Egg Software. And he made me a limited edition. Let me just grab it from the shelf so I can talk about it properly.
Yeah, no problem.
He's made me a limited edition original game box for it, and it really is absolutely amazing. What they've done is they've created a it's the same size as a double cassette box. If you remember those,
yeah,
it's those plastic cases. So he's made one of those plastic cases, and they've redone, professionally done all the artwork. So you open it up, and I really got to blog about this actually because
I'd love to see a picture of this.
Yeah, I'll do that actually today. And so when you open it up, you've got the original inlay, which has got all the updated graphics on it. It's got instructions in Japanese, English, French, and Spanish.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know, really great attention to detail. And then you've got the entire instruction manual inside as well, which they reproduced and recreated.
Yeah.
Which is just astonishing. And a whole load of artwork inside. So it's really, really brilliant. And best of all, it actually comes on original Amstrad 3-inch floppy disk.
Oh, fantastic. Where can we find this game? So for anyone that hasn't actually played this or hasn't even heard of this, where can we go to find this game and where can we get it from?
Okay, so the best place to go is the CPC Wiki site, which is www.cpcwiki.eu, or just do a Google search.
Yeah.
And probably the best way is to do a Google search. I know it's on the CPC Wiki site, but I can't remember offhand the exact URL of it. But what we can do is actually we can, when the podcast gets published, we can probably put a little link on the bottom of that to where that is, because I think it will be interesting, because it's an absolutely fantastic remake. It really is. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing. And And just, because it's based on the original Spectrum game, which indeed the actual original version was.
Yeah.
So the original Spectrum code was fantastic. It's a really faithful conversion. So what they've basically done is they've just ripped out the guts of the graphic engine and the sound engine. They've just completely redone it.
Yeah.
Oh, if anyone does want to play this remake, you do need to know, if you want to play it on an original machine, it is 128K only. That's, mm-hmm. So if you try and load up onto 464 without a memory expansion or 664, it will unfortunately tell you that you can't do that. So just disappointment. Just I think it is actually disc only as well. So you, mm-hmm. what you'll have to do is, if you'll probably need to get, you need to have an Amstrad with a disc drive or an Amstrad with a disc interface. Because what you can actually do, if you look on the CPC wiki, Amstrad owners probably already know this, but you can actually connect a 3.5-inch PC floppy drive up to an Amstrad, and then you can just write the date against your PC. So that's by far the easiest way to play it on the original hardware. By far the easiest way to play it anyway is probably just load up a copy of WinApe, the other popular Amstrad emulators, and load the disk image into there, and it will play just fine.
Okay then, mate. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to start rounding this up. I'd like to say thank you for actually being on the show. Have you got any thanks or anything you'd like to say to anyone, plug anyone's site?
Well, I mean, I'd normally be plugging your site, but we're on there already.
Yeah.
I just want to say really a big thank you to everyone in the community and everyone out there on the Retro Gaming, on the Retro Gamer forums, on the CPC Wiki forums, World of Spectrum, C64 Lemon, all of you guys who I've been posting. I've started posting updates for the Starquake remake and some really, really nice feedback. So thanks for the comments. Also as well, on my own site, if anyone's got any comments or suggestions for the remake site, for the remake, please, you know, feel free to sure. those on the actual site.
What's the URL code for that again? What is it?
It's actually very easy. It's www.endangermice.co.uk.
Hey.
I'll take it straight into my site. It's absolutely fantastic having comments on the forum. I mean, that's brilliant, but the problem is I'd be much better to have comments actually on the site, because then I can keep them all together more easily. And I have limited time. I'm very forgetful. I'll probably forget to keep checking back on the forum. Same with the YouTube videos as well. You know, if there's anything you don't like, say, and that would be really good. Because if it's really useful, you know, really useful feedback is great. Because I want to make this remake really, really good, and I want you guys to enjoy playing it. So if I can get as much feedback, you know, and even if it's just like, you know, that's really cool, that's looking great, that's good, because I actually know I'm on the right track.
Fantastic. Now, before we say goodbye properly, you need a retro gaming tune to close the show off with. What would you go for?
I'm going to go for probably one of my favorite tunes ever. And this is one that hasn't actually been played. So this is another reason. It is from the good old Commodore 64. Well, it's an Amstrad version of the tune. And it's from a little-known game. I think it was from the 199, possibly Mastertronic range. Theme tune written by our good old friend Rob Hubbard.
Yep.
And the game is One Man and His Droid.
Ah, fantastic. All right, so guys, thank you very much. You've been listening to Retro Asylum, and we'll see you next week with episode 25. And on episode 25, we've got the big Amiga 500 giveaway, and plus we've got all the Play Expo chit chat down there, and we got an interview as well. So guys, see you next time.
See you guys. We'll be right back.
The bottom of 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 the bott